the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. I'm your humble host, Peter B., and this program is supported by listeners who've helped us get this podcast launched. I want to identify Nancy Kilgore, who has renewed her monthly subscription. You can do it for as little as $5 a month. The info is on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. And to kick off our program today, David K. Johnston returns. Former New York Times reporter. He's the author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He also wrote Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else. He loves those lengthy subtitles. David, how are you today?
Terrific, Peter.
And he's now also teaching a course in the history of business regulation at the Syracuse University College of Law. And I want to draw on that expertise in just a moment, David. But first, I wanted to share with you an interesting new cartoon. We actually show cartoons on audio. Used to do it on the radio, and now we do it on podcasting. And if you want to see the visuals of this, go to markfiore.com. He does these fabulous flash political cartoons, and it's F-I-O-R-E. That's Italian for fire, markfiore.com. And this was his tribute to the one-year anniversary of... The first major meltdown, the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy on Wall Street.
1 year ago, right about now, the economy keeled over like an overstuffed sow. First Lehman, then Merrill, the high times were finished. Soon U.S. wealth was $14 trillion diminished. We had to act fast or face Great Depression too. Let the big bailouts begin, starting with you. First Bush, then Barack, had to fix things at once. We must shape up those banks and their high wire stunts. But banks bought up banks, gladly too big to fail, and sent millions to Congress so their views would prevail. Now bonuses are back and funny finances abound, but all must be well, there's a market rebound. Executives, the bankers, have wallets quite blubbery, and oh, by the way, it's a jobless recovery.
That's at markfiore.com, and it's kind of an interesting way to look at these issues. And David, recently the president and the chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, have been giving cautious but positive descriptions of the state of the economy. And Bernanke in particular the other day edged very close to pronouncing the recession over. Now, I regard that as a little edgy because, as we know, you often need a quarter or two of performance before you can really define the beginning or end of a recession. Are they trying to talk us out of this? And in your view, do the underlying figures and statistics support the cheerleading that we're hearing?
Well, by the technical measures of how the Committee of Economists at the National Bureau of Economic Research determines there's a contraction or expansion in the economy, we may find out that, in fact, recovery has begun. Jobs are a lagging indicator. Hiring starts only after the recovery is underway. But that said, we are in such a deep hole, and the prospects for an expansion are for such a mild expansion, so narrow in its scope, that for a lot of people, this is going to hurt for a long, long time. One little statistic, Peter, from 2006 to 2007, because this data just came out, the bottom almost half of Americans who make less than $30,000 saw their incomes decline. They went down by 2%, which what that means is that almost half of Americans in 2007 got 51 weeks of the income they got for 52 weeks the year before. At the same time, at the other end, there was a 90-some billion-dollar net increase in income, and 22 cents out of every dollar of increased income to all 305 or so million Americans went to 18,000 households. So that the poor are literally getting poorer, the rich are getting richer, and we're going to find that this recovery will not generate jobs. We're going to have a huge number of people who will leave the workforce. And, of course, then the government will be able to say, well, see, the unemployment rate is coming down because it measures how many people looking for jobs have jobs.
And as you look back over the last year, number one, were these bailouts necessary, and did they have the desired effect? And I'm let's first talk about the TARP fund, the $750 billion that was parceled out in a couple of different installments, and then we'll talk about the money that the Fed pumped into the banking system.
Well, from 3 days after the announcement of the first bailout plan, I've been out being very skeptical about it. The evidence suggests that we needed to take some actions because confidence was falling apart in the banking system. But I think the larger, deeper problem with the whole series of bailouts that we engaged in was we bailed out the investment bankers and the commercial bankers who made bad decisions and bad bets and who should lose their money and go broke and lose their jobs instead of bailing out ordinary folks. Mm-hmm. And I know if, like me, you know, you're paying your mortgage, you're behaving responsible, the idea that the guy next door is going to get a deal on his mortgage drives you crazy. But instead of taking care of the guy next door, whose situation will affect the value of your house, we bailed out the people who have private jets and yachts and who need it least.
And did the TARP bailout money, was it properly targeted, or do we even know? When you talk to, when you hear, I haven't talked to her, but when you hear Elizabeth Warren, who is the Harvard professor in charge of the oversight of the TARP money, she makes it sound like they don't even have receipts, they don't know who got the money, they don't know what the terms were. Some banks have returned money in order to avoid any limitation on executive pay and some of the other strings that were attached to it. But overall, do we know where that money went, and do we know if it had any of the desired effect? Did it free up credit, for example?
Well, I would listen very closely to Professor Warren. I've known her for about 20 years. She is one of the most thoughtful, competent, public-spirited people in this country and is deeply respected in her field for her knowledge. Particularly the work she's done in the past on what goes on in bankruptcy that had changed the fundamental assumptions we had in our society about who goes bankrupt. And basically, the politically connected were able to get money out of the government, billions of dollars of money, more easily than you can get a car loan, without proper oversight, without responding to her questions when she's empowered to look into this, and without a real understanding of what they're doing. And, you know, there's a new book out by one of President Bush's speechwriters where at one point he quotes him as saying in the Oval Office that he doesn't understand what's going on and says, why am I doing this? It should trouble us deeply that Goldman Sachs, which is the principal bad actor in all of this, Goldman Sachs was bailed out. And, you know, when Goldman... we bailed out AIG, the big insurer, for financial bets it made. And what we really did when we did that was bail out its counterparty, which was Goldman. Goldman would have lost one-third of its net worth, about $13 billion, if you and I hadn't given them the money. And what did Goldman say to the public? Oh, well, we didn't need the money. Well, then give it back. The rest of us do. The schools need it. The hospitals need it. The roads need it. The fire departments need it. The libraries need it.
And we have a bunch of Goldman Sachs alumni who populate the Barack Obama economic team.
Oh, they're Goldman Sachs has for a long time been all over the place. In fact, Matt Tobias, in his piece in Rolling Stone, had a line, one of those lines, I wish I'd come up with it. I'm sure you do, too. He said he was trying to make a chart of all the connections Goldman Sachs has to the government,
mm-hmm.
and he concluded it was like making a chart of everything.
Now, what about this is fascinating to me because I believe it was in late July or early August. The PBS NewsHour did a four-night, I think it was, installment of Chairman Bernanke going to Kansas City, where he held a public meeting, a town hall. There were no mob-driven people shouting at him, but there were a lot of thoughtful questions. And the way he answered them really was striking to me because he did not acknowledge the billions and, in fact, trillions of dollars that have either been pledged or put into the system by the Fed over the past year. He limited his discussion to the $750 billion TARP fund, and I thought that was seriously misleading. And I'm curious if you saw any of those exchanges, David, because, again, I thought he was trying to pump up the confidence of the American public and the investor community. But I don't think he was being forthcoming. I thought that he was presenting a very narrow set of the issues that have been dealt with over this past year.
Well, Peter, I did not see those, but I have seen and read many remarks Chairman Bernanke has made on this. And there's two things you have to keep in mind. Number one, first of all, luckily for us, his academic scholarly research was on the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so he made sure we did not make the mistake that was made almost 80 years ago of cutting off the supply of money. The mistake he made was not spinning it up enough, because a recession means there's not enough demand. People can't buy things, therefore the people get their hours cut, they get laid off, and you want to have more spending. I'm not surprised at all, however, that Bernanke's fundamental strategy has been to focus on what he wants focused on and nothing else, because his job in many ways is to be a cheerleader. Banking in the modern world is based in large part on the concept of trust. You put your paycheck in the bank, they immediately loan out 80% of your paycheck to some guy buying a car or a house or charging something to his credit card, and then when the car dealer comes in and deposits the price of the automobile into his checking account, they loan that out so that you get this leverage effect, and mm-hmm. that's why the modern economy has grown. But it also depends on trust. People have to believe my money is safe, and if they don't, you get awful, terrible problems.
And so, I understand that point, but shouldn't the Fed chairman be honest about the amount of money that Treasury and the Federal Reserve have either loaned to the banks, advanced to them, or pumped into the system? Because it goes well beyond the TARP money.
Well, yes, of course. In one sense, they are honest. You can go and look at the financial statements of the Fed, and you can see how much their balance sheet has ballooned. It's roughly doubled in size. On the other hand, this is PR that he is doing. This is not about truth. It's the job of Congress to sit him down and ask the tough questions. Unfortunately, doesn't matter which party's in office, we're not seeing a lot of that kind of really tough questions. I mean, somewhat better than it was, but we're still not seeing the real tough questions about what's going on in the banking sector. And, you know, we've had no real reform. Where the banks now, the big banks, are right back to doing the very same risky things they were doing a year ago. They're proposing a variety of new things that are starting to come up. We're seeing tax shelters start to come back, new ones. Just today, the Treasury went after one that's apparently aimed at privately held businesses as opposed to publicly traded companies. And nothing has changed except that you and I turned all this money over to these rich people who behaved badly and were not made to suffer the consequences of what they've done. So what happens? Hey, didn't harm us. They're right back in business doing mm-hmm. the same thing because there was no lesson learned.
Now, the FBI announced this week that the number of cases that they have opened, particularly framed around mortgage fraud, now amounts to over 2,600, and most of those cases involve losses of at least $1 million. Is that a significant level of investigation and enforcement, given the scope of the meltdown?
No. And One of the things that the public, I think, needs to really appreciate is that, you know, in local police, when you have a murderer, a rapist, somebody who's committing repeated burglaries, we practice something called specific deterrence. We try to arrest every single drug dealer, every murderer, every violent felon. At the federal level, we do something different. It is called general deterrence. And the theory there is there may be 1,000 people who committed this crime, so you find the case that's a slam dunk to convict, and the person who is notable or famous, you prosecute them on the theory that it will intimidate everyone else and they won't commit the crime.
We're going to make an example out of you, Buster.
That's right, and all the rest of you better be aware or you could go to a prison for 25 years. Well, they prosecute so few of these cases that it's not working. General deterrence is not without a basis, but you've got to prosecute a lot more people than they are. And why aren't we doing that? Well, because this is one of the deeper underlying structural problems we have in our country. We are spending so much money on subsidies to the rich, giveaways to corporations, military spending, and interest on the debt that we don't have money for the basics needed to make a society function. Proper education, especially higher education, which we've now turned into a business where people have to borrow money to get an education. Infrastructure. So that we can move goods around the country and services very efficiently. Healthcare, where we rank 37th in the world behind places like the Dominican Republic. And justice. We've cut way back on the amount of money we put into justice, and in both civil and criminal, but particularly civil.
You know, Bernie Madoff has gone to jail, and it's interesting the reaction to him because there have been a few other Ponzi schemes exposed. But do you have any confidence that the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has renewed its commitment to enforcement? Or are we still operating under the voluntary enforcement that the Bush administration and Chris Cox were promoting?
Well, this is one where the glass is half full. Chris Cox put in place a rule that the staff could not undertake an investigation without getting approval from the commission. I mean, think about that. You're a homicide detective in San Francisco. There's a murder, and you can't go investigate it until you get the Board of Supervisors to approve it. But that just was throwing cold water on investigations. It's one of the things that helped Bernie Madoff and Alan Sanford and others. That stopped. The staff now is empowered to conduct investigations to a pretty far level before they need to get further approval. The downside is, we are still collecting an enormous amount of money. The last time I looked, it was more than $500 million a year, more in fees to finance the SEC than we're spending on it. So there are way too few cops on the beat. And many complaints come in. They don't get heard. Many of the most seasoned investigators had their careers destroyed during the Bush administration, where throughout the government, I mean, at the USGS in Menlo Park, at the Environmental Protection Agency, at the SEC, at the IRS, the Bush people went through and made life hell for the most aggressive, most experienced investigators and got rid of them. So now you have these inexperienced young investigators, many of whom, you know, this is subtle stuff, and they may not get it. So we're on the right track, but nowhere near large enough police force to police Wall Street.
David, we have an interesting, I think she is the most, the least senior member of Congress right now, Jackie Speier. She was elected in the special after Tom Lantos died, and she distinguished herself here in the California legislature on banking, finance, and insurance issues. And she has raised a critical matter related to the failure of Lehman Brothers, which was permitted to go under without any kind of a bailout. And it turns out that there were a lot of municipal and state funds that were invested in some high-yield funds with Lehman Brothers. And apparently there was no insurance on those. And so there are municipalities here in California, the state is broke, and they, as part of the so-called budget fix, they borrowed money from county and municipal governments that those entities don't have. And one of the reasons, not the only, but a contributor, is the failure of Lehman Brothers. Are you aware of any efforts to try to cover those losses to the government entities who had invested with Lehman?
No. And this is a great example of lessons not learned. Do you remember, I think it was about 13 years ago, Orange County went bankrupt?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because of the mismanagement of their money by the elected local official who was trying to earn higher interest. And so in an effort to get return on principal, he lost the principal, didn't get it returned. We haven't learned that lesson. You know, local governments have no business investing in high-yield securities, which are risky. They should be investing in investment-grade securities and nothing else. The losses from Lehman are all over the place. There are businesses that lost money. There are people who lost their whole fortunes because they listened to a salesman who told them something. And here's, by the way, a flaw in the law. Your salesman from a place like Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, is not required to act in your interest, something called fiduciary duty or a duty of loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to put your interest ahead of his own. So he's pushing on you a product that's inappropriate. And, you know, you would think, well, a big county in California ought to have sophisticated people. No, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And they shouldn't be investing in these things because they don't. And furthermore, it's your and my money as taxpayers. We didn't pay the taxes to have it invested,
right,
except in, you know, structure, education, things like that, not in the stock market and the
mm-hmm.
bond market.
Mm-hmm. So this past week, President Obama went to Wall Street, and he was backing up some of the regulatory reform proposals that were first announced in June. And there hasn't been much focus on this. Obviously, the healthcare issues have taken center stage. But what is your take on the level of the proposals that have been made? Do they actually address the critical problems that we have been dealing with, the depths of in the last year? But they certainly were percolating for a long time. And is he really just kind of paying lip service? Because, after all, many of us are quite aware that Obama got quite a bit of money, early money, critical money in his campaign last year from Wall Street and from Goldman Sachs in particular.
Right. Well, let's remember that in Washington there's only one party. Forget about Republicans and Democrats. It's the Green Party and the Greenback Party. And it just has different wings. You know, there are liberals and conservatives in it, and there are pro-civil rights and anti-civil rights people in it. But it's the party of the Greenback. The reform proposals from the administration amount to, in essence, gentlemen, would you be nice, please? Would you behave? Would you think of the public interest? When Obama went to Wall Street to give his big speech,
mm-hmm.
Interesting fact, not one CEO of a financial institution was in the audience, according to the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Not one.
Yeah.
And, you know, asking investment bankers who are paid, the more they push the edge of the envelope, to pull back, you know, that's like asking, you know, a heroin addict with his needle poised to go in to decide to quit right then.
Yeah.
That's just, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things I'm teaching at Syracuse is that all societies have regulated finance from Hammurabi forward. And you know how we used to deal with people who behaved like this in the ancient world?
Didn't we cut off their fingers or something?
Oh, we killed them.
Okay.
don't beat around. We killed him. I mean, yes, there were various other penalties, but basically people who price gouged, we killed them. We mm-hmm. put them to death, and lots of them. And you have to regulate your finance sector. Every society in the world has understood this, except, unfortunately, this transcendent notion in America that somehow this is anti-capitalism. You know, Felix Royton, who is, Mr. Capitalist, right? Used to run, I think it was Lazard Frères,
right.
was
mm-hmm.
instrumental in reviving New York in the 70s,
right.
and who's a perfect example of a capitalist. He has been out giving speeches saying, I don't understand what's going on here. You must regulate capitalism or it will destroy itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what the president's proposing is just timid and mild and reflects, you know, just as Senator Baucus' health care bill was basically written by the for-profit healthcare companies.
Mm-hmm.
The proposal put forth by the president is a lot of pablum.
Well, and let's just take a moment on the Baucus proposal, because I was floored to see $400 billion in there, which is essentially a bailout to the most profitable industry I know of. And the Baucus package mandates that people get coverage, so they are forcing tens of millions of people into the arms of the for-profit insurance companies, and then there's going to be $400 billion worth of subsidies for those who are low or moderate income families who need a little help to pay the exorbitant prices that these companies charge. And there's no regulation in there to limit the rate of increase. There's no way, there's no proposal to regulate them like a utility or other monopolistic commons type entities. And so I'm really floored by that. I don't know about you.
Peter, this was the most astonishing bill. I mean, it was effectively written by the for-profit insurance companies. And I think the real problem here is this. You cannot have a capitalist market system without insurance. But healthcare is not a capitalist investment system. It's a service. Nobody buys kindergarten insurance or lifeguard insurance or police insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Those are public services we provide so that we have a well-functioning society. And every other modern country has figured this out. And we've listened to these incredible lies, you know, the Canadians all hate their healthcare system. No, they don't. Go to Canada. There are a few cranks who are unhappy, and people are not thrilled at you for elective surgeries. You wait a while. But, you know, a couple of years ago, I got skin cancer. It took me 7 months from the day it was diagnosed to get surgery. We have 47 million people with no access to health care. And I went to one of these town hall meetings where a clearly very prosperous man, I talked to him a little bit afterwards, said, it's a lie that people have health care. Anybody can just go to the emergency room. And I walked over to him. I said, well, what do you do if you have cancer, which is a chronic disease that mm-hmm. requires long-term treatment? You go to the emergency room.
Yeah. Right.
With no clue. And we're spending way too much money. Every sixth dollar in our economy is now going to health care. The reason that 90% of Americans are not seeing their incomes grow is because so many of that group who have health care are seeing all of their money diverted to health care. Many companies' workers are taking pay cuts, or if you're having to make larger copays or have larger deductibles, that's effectively a pay cut.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a solution to this. Everybody else in the world has figured it out. About 40% of Americans already have it through Medicare, being a government employee or retiree. It's called single payer.
Yep.
You can still have a competitive market. You can still have doctors who have their own practice. You don't have to have a system of clinics, but you need to have single payer. And all we're doing here is trying to create two parallel systems. Well, it costs a lot more to run two systems, and it costs tremendously a lot more when the incentives in the corporate side are to deny care.
Yep.
And, you know, Congress took testimony 12 years ago from a doctor, Linda Pino, who testified, I denied care to a man, caused his death, and I was rewarded for this by the company because I saved them $500,000 by killing him.
Mm-hmm.
We have death panels, Peter. They're just run by corporations.
Absolutely. I call them death squads because
yes.
That's what they are. And, of course, a lot of people say, well, you want to get your health care from the post office or the DMV? Well, I'll tell you this. If I went to the DMV and said, for example, my doctor has recommended a colonoscopy, and this is true, they're most likely to say, well, sure, go ahead, because it's going to save us money in the long run if we discover a polyp in there. But what happened is I went to my for-profit insurance carrier, and it's a low-cost, no-name. I shifted to it a couple of years ago because my other carrier got too expensive. And they said, well, unless you're sick, we won't approve a colonoscopy. Now,
right.
that's just totally backwards, and it's counter to their interests, and it's counter to my interest. But by denying me that, they saved the insurance company $1,800 or $2,000, and yep. that's all they care about. And so, you know, the kind of bullshit that has been injected into what is not even a debate is really striking, and I think that the Obama team and the Democrats have bungled this so badly that I don't even think we're going to get half a loaf here. We're going to get, you know, a little dinner roll.
Well, you know, Peter, I have eight children, grown children, and one of them, 34 years old, has had two heart attacks and quadruple bypass surgery. Just bad biological luck on his part.
Mm-hmm.
His employer got rid of him because they did not want to have to have somebody with this kind of a medical expense. We've been trying to buy him health insurance because his COBRA will run out.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to insure him. Now, we could go get him probably declared disabled with some effort, and then the government would pick up the bills, and then what? He doesn't do anything productive? I mean, this is beyond stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I also have three friends in my life who all died because they didn't have health insurance and they got treatable cancers. One of them, a documentarian who was going to make a movie about me and died before he finished it, like most documentary filmmakers, didn't have two nickels to rub together. And the day he was 65, he was in to see the doctor. And the doctor told him, I wish you'd come in about 8 or 9 months ago because you'd be fine, but you've got a skin cancer that's metastasized and you're going to die.
Oh, boy.
There's a word for this, by the way. And remember, you hear all these politicians, especially people connected with things like the Tea Party protests, who are always invoking Judeo-Christian heritage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this false claim that America was founded with the intent that it be a Christian nation. Well, excuse me. The Bible I've got on my shelf says that you're supposed to sacrifice for the poor. It's wrong to take from the poor to give to the rich. But that's what we're doing in our healthcare system.
Yeah. Well, and it comes down to, in criminal terms, voluntary manslaughter.
Politically, I'd agree with you. Not legally, but politically, absolutely. That's exactly what it is. And I think it's very troubling that the unions, that the churches that actually teach what's in the Bible, the synagogues that actually teach what's in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
have not organized people to show up. They have ceded this debate to people who are incredibly misinformed. And by the way, I got to take one little dig at the Tea Party protesters.
Please do.
They all come and say, we're protesting high taxes. The Boston Tea Party was a protest not against high taxes, but against a tax exemption for the richest people in England.
Oh, come on. Don't bother me with those details. It's an image thing.
Right.
Oh, this is amazing. Well, let's come back to Wall Street and regulatory issues here, because I'd like your take on if there were three or four critical things that are missing from the Obama-Geithner re-regulation package. What are they, and how should we try to move toward them?
Okay. The first thing to do is in the area of compensation. I think a company should be allowed to pay whatever they want to pay. Okay, if the shareholders are willing to put up with having all their profits go to the senior executives, that's their business, not yours and mine. But because the executives are taking risks with your and my money, pension funds of public agencies that you and I are taxed for, our retirement savings, etc., their payouts to themselves should be delayed. You make a deal, you can't say, oh, well, this deal will make a profit of X, so I'm going to take it now. Uh-uh. You get paid when the deal is over. And if you have to wait 10 years to get your money, you got to wait 10 years to get your money.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the books. You'll get paid when the deal is done and it worked. Concomitant with that, the Congress should pass a law that if your pay agreement doesn't provide that you have to give back future losses if you've gained on the upside, so it isn't a heads I win, tails I don't lose situation.
Yeah.
You would inject a lot of more responsible conduct into this. That's the first one. The second one is...
Can I just jump in without destroying your train of thought? What you suggest there is something that I've long argued could be fixed by enforcing the fiduciary responsibility that directors of a corporation have. Because under the corporate structure, they are required to represent the shareholders and their interests. And that clearly has not been happening. And I believe that if we enforce the fiduciary obligations on the example you raised earlier is not everyone, but just a few, that we would set a tone that would change things sharply and end the coziness between directors and top management.
Absolutely. And, of course, who are most of the corporate directors in this country? They're executives of other companies. There's a very incestuous relationship here. And equally important, Peter, mutual funds and large public pension plans
mm-hmm.
it typically don't vote their shares. Well, what was identified by Means and Gardner back in the 1930s as the principal problem with corporate governance? It was the shareholders weren't exerting their rights as owners. And when you saw unions try to do this, you'll know Fox News and its friends all went crazy saying, oh, they're trying to throw their weight around. Excuse me, the pension union pension plans are owners. They ought to be exercising their rights.
Mm-hmm.
And throwing out managements that they don't like because they're the owners. So we certainly need to find a way to do exactly that, to require directors of companies to act solely and exclusively in the interests of the shareholders. The next thing we need to do is recognize something about hedge funds. Hedge funds are huge, unregulated, non-disclosure pools of money operating offshore. I mean, the money's traded from desks in New York and San Francisco and Greenwich, Connecticut, but legally it's offshore and untaxed. And they depend on borrowed money. And we know from some court records that have come out that, well, they claim the borrowing is 30 to 1. That's like buying a house with 3% down.
Mm-hmm.
Often the invested stakes are borrowed, and the real leverage rate can be 100 to 1 or 250 to 1 in one case that we have court records on. Well, that imposes risks on all the rest of us. There's no reason that we can't require an enormous amount of disclosure and take these things back into the U.S. and through tax rules and other rules, we can say you can't operate in secret, you can't not pay your taxes, you can't be offshore. Banks and hedge funds are like Siamese twins joined at the hip with the same circulatory system.
Hmm.
So if the hedge fund gets sick, the banking system gets sick and dies. We need to address this issue of hedge funds that have grown up out of nowhere and many of which are badly run. I think it was Warren Buffett, somebody who said that first you get the innovators, then you get the imitators, then you get the idiots. So we're in the idiot stage.
Mm-hmm. And should derivatives be controlled on an exchange as well?
Well, we certainly need to address this. You know, the value of what's called the notional value of derivatives is something like 10 times the net worth of the planet.
Right.
And it is so huge, it boggles the mind. And I have literally seen derivative contracts that say things like the amount owing shall be the square of the difference between the change in price of the Thai baht to the Russian ruble over a certain period of time.
Let me follow that. Is there any hope that we can actually see these kinds of reforms? Because as our cartoon Mark Fiore suggested, with or without the bailouts, these companies have been showering our elected leaders with campaign cash, and it does appear to be working.
Well, and there you get to the third real reform we need, Peter. The real problem in this country is the political donor class picks who wins. The Supreme Court of the U.S., just as it decided that racial segregation was lawful in the 1800s, has decided that dollars to politicians are a form of free speech. Well, in a society where all the gains are going to the top, where most people are struggling to just get by, that means the free speech is going to go to those people with excess incomes, with big fortunes, that they can invest in renting politicians and winning them over for what they want.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to break that system. That is a very difficult fight, but if we don't break it, it will, over time, I believe, erode our republic. And eventually it will lead to a situation in which children will sit down and pick up history books that have a chapter beginning with the words, "The United States of America was."
Very well put, David. I always enjoy talking with you. You are clear, you understand the issues, and you help a guy like me who hit the wall in Econ 101 get a better picture of what's going on. David K. Johnston, thank you for joining us today. And I just noticed here at Amazon.com that Free Lunch, your most recent book, is available in a Kindle edition. So if you've got one of those electronic book devices, it's only $10 to get free lunch for your Kindle. David, great to talk with you.
Thank you, Peter.
The budget mess in California is only getting worse, and the university system is taking a really big hit.
They're closing all the libraries. They're closing all the libraries. They're closing all the libraries. They're locking hallowed doors.
Ah, but the prisons, they got money.
They're closing all the libraries. Doubling my parking fees. They're building prisons in old schoolyards. Lord used to love it there.
That's Richard March. It's the blues for California under Schwarzenegger. And if you don't live here in the Golden State, you've probably heard reports of the huge budget shortfall, the hostage taking by the radical right-wing Republicans who are loyal to Grover Norquist, not to the people of California or even their own putative Republican governor. And there is some reaction now. We're joined by Joshua Clover. He's an associate professor of English at the University of California, Davis. And he helped draft a petition that has now been signed by more than 700 faculty members. And they are planning a walkout to protest these budget cuts. It's scheduled for September 24th. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me what the mood is among the professionals, the faculty members in the UC system, as you see the higher education dream that California built over decades being systematically dismantled.
Well, I should say a couple things first. One is I should mention that the petition that I helped co-author now has, as of right now, 992 signatures, so right around 1,000, which I think is rather unprecedented in the history of UC faculty political mobilization. But I should also say that it's no longer just a UC faculty walkout. As you or some of your listeners may know, at least one union, the University Professional and Technical Employees, with 12,000 members, is striking on September 24th. At least some of another union, Q, which is the clerical workers, will be sympathy striking as well. And perhaps most importantly, the University of California Student Association, which is the governing body for all UC students, undergraduate, graduate, and professional, resolved to support the walkout and work in coalition with workers and faculty as of last Sunday. So it's no longer a faculty walkout, although that's what it was originally called. Mm-hmm. It's a system-wide walkout. But I think you're right to... I myself can only speak for what the mood is among faculty, which is the people I work with most closely. And first, I should say, honestly, it's impossible to get 10 faculty members in a room without having 12 opinions. that's one of the things we do is try and think, try and be thoughtful about issues and try and come up with our own opinions rather than received wisdom.
And out of those 10, 3 will try to publish, right?
Well, if they want to keep their jobs, hopefully they all will. But one of the most remarkable moments of consensus has been this, that I think no one disagrees that the university administration has steered away from the principles that have made the University of California a beacon for education, not just in California, not just nationally, but internationally. Among those principles is one we particularly cherish, which makes the institution unique, which is called shared governance, which is the assumption that the administration and the faculty will share the obligation to honor the California Master Plan for Education, to honor the university's paramount mission. And that has been almost totally abandoned purely by the administration, which appointed the president with emergency powers over the summer and has yet to renounce that position and has gone about ignoring every faculty recommendation it has received.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because sure. the Board of Regents is, what, some 18 members, and they really are people who are there because of political connections. Now, there are a few people, constitutional officers, like the lieutenant governor, who have a regent post while they serve in that office. But most of these are political people. They are not academics. They are not people who really, I think, are committed deeply to the mission. Now, I know that they cheer for the teams and they show up for the meetings, but my sense is that many of them really don't have in their blood a commitment to the type of education as you do.
I won't compare myself to them. It's certainly true that the majority of them are not professional educators, and their experience is in other walks. And I don't hang all the blame for this at the doorstep of the regents. There's no doubt that California is having a fiscal crisis. There's no doubt that the legislature and the governor have chosen to defund education. There's no doubt that we have certain legislative situations. Proposition 13 will be the one everyone is most familiar with that, mm-hmm. that limits possibilities for tax base for education, among other things. But I think that along with this budget crisis, we do have a crisis of priorities with the regents and with the University of California Office of the President and the kinds of choices that they have made to deal with this economic crisis. It's clear that other choices can be made from the very choices they've made. To choose just one example, the number of administrators earning more than six figures increased in only 2 years, between 2006 and 2008. The number of administrators earning more than six figures increased by 47%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard to imagine exactly why the university suddenly needed so many more highly paid administrators when they were cutting the salaries and furloughing and laying off so many so-called bracket one employees, that is to say those making less than $40,000, the mm-hmm. most vulnerable members of the University of California.
There's also been expose after expose of fat severance checks written to people, huge bonuses and perks delivered to some of these chancellors. And as we have seen, there's been this increase of 227% in tuition, and that's just in the last 4 or is it 5 years?
I think the number I have, and you may have better numbers than I do, but is since 2001, it's increased 277%. And if the current uh-huh. proposal goes through, which is for yet another 32% increase, it will have increased more than 300% or more than threefold. In this decade.
And Joshua, with that track record, the other thing that I have followed is the voting patterns of the Board of Regents. And they have rubber stamped every increase in tuition and fees that has been brought before them over this last 6 or 7 years, with one exception, the lieutenant governor. And I will disclose, I've done some political consulting for John Garamendi, but he doesn't call me to decide how to vote at the Board of Regents. And he has been the only no vote on most of the increases for students. And he also has voted against some of the pay packages for these top executives and chancellors. The rest of them are just sheep who go along with whatever Mark Udoff and Dick Blum tell them to do.
I do certainly agree that at the Regents meeting in July, John Garamendi took the most principled positions of any of the Regents. I speak only for myself, in my opinion. One of the things that seems clear is that the Regents have declined to dedicate themselves to pursuing increased public funding for the university. The routes they've gone have been private donations, grants for the sciences, which turn out, if you read the very careful studies, Chris Newfield's book on making the university is the most thorough about this, but those routes of funding turn out not to be sufficient to generate the revenues the University of California needs. The struggle for public funding is the only thing that's going to do it, and the Regents have more or less declined to press that case, to make that case, to go that route, and they've been very happy, it seems to me, to shift that burden to the students, who now pay twice as much of a percentage of the total university revenue in tuition as they once did.
Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is not called a tax increase, but it is a huge burden to working families in California and those who send students here from other places, because while the Republicans have held firm on this no new taxes pledge, it has done incredible damage to the state in many respects. But I believe that this disinvestment in higher education, both at the UC level and the California State University level, is something that we're going to pay for decades. And it is not sensible. It will not help keep us competitive. We have slipped from the number 5 economy in the world to number 7, and that decline will continue. And we will have to expand the number of H-1B visas to bring in people who have the expertise that our high-tech and other industries need, because these needs are simply not going to be met by the higher education, public education system here in California.
It's certainly true that the budget changes being implemented by the Regents and by the Office of the President have disproportionately affected the lowest paid workers and students. I think that is a stealth tax, exactly as you say, and it's a stealth tax on the most vulnerable members of our community. I also think, there's been a lot of talk about the need to provide a quality education for the citizens of California, and a certain amount of anger about increasing the number of students from out of state and international students because they pay more. And I wouldn't like to see us go some sort of jingoistic pro-California route. Rather, I'd like to remember exactly what it is about the UC system which has made it a an education system which people from across the country and across the world go through extraordinary effort to send their children to. Mm-hmm. And the things that made us that institution are exactly the things that are being sacrificed now.
So, Joshua, with this walkout, and I fully support it, in fact, I would like to have seen some activism from faculty and students sooner than this. That aside, what do you hope to achieve? Is this to garner media attention and get the public awareness amped up? Do you have specific proposals that the regents either have rejected or ignored that you hope to bring forward?
Well, we've made three demands, which I'd be happy to articulate for you. But the first thing I should say is the main thing we hoped to achieve, we've already achieved entirely, which is to say we wanted to move toward being in solidarity with and coalition with the students and the workers at the University of California. That kind of coalition between faculty, students, and workers is unprecedented in the history of the University of California. And that has formed, I agree with you, I would have liked to have seen it form earlier, but I think it's tremendous that it has formed now. And I think that has been one of the great goals. And going forward, because I think this will honestly be a long and serious struggle for the future of public education in California, and that we've already achieved. Obviously, the administration is trying to spin this walkout as sort of students versus teachers. Listen, they don't have a lot of moves. That's one of them. They're going to keep on making it to try and sort of set groups against each other. But at this point, I think that's pretty implausible, given that the kind of resolutions we're seeing coming out of student unions and strikes we're seeing coming out of labor. So I think it's clear this coalition has been formed. Now, we as faculty have articulated three pretty simple goals, and they are these. The first is protection for the most vulnerable in the UC community. We've demanded no furloughs or pay cuts for people earning less than $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
The second is respect for the democratic process. We were told that each campus would get to decide how the furloughs that were handed down via the emergency powers. We were told we would get to decide on each campus how they're implemented. We decided quite fairly, I think, how they would be implemented, at which point the Office of the President said, oh, we actually don't like your decision. So the part where we told you got to decide, we take that back. And so we would like to see you return to respect for democratic process, because we do not see how the university can be set on a right course without that. And the third is just for transparency of the budget. People keep saying, reasonably enough, I think, so what's your budget plan, smart guy? And, you know, I think the only fair answer is we would be happy to discuss possible alternative budgets if the University Office of the President would stop being secretive and disingenuous, as they demonstrably have been, about the situation of the budget currently.
What's the level of confidence or lack thereof in Mark Udoff?
My sense, speaking for myself and the many faculty and staff and students I've spoken with over the last couple of months of organizing this, is I'm going to go with zero. I could be off by a little, but my estimate is zero.
So is it time to demand a replacement? He's only been here a couple of years.
It's true. Well, again, let me be tempered and reasonable. I think that he sits in a difficult position. I think that if he were to give up the chair of president, whoever inherited it would also find themselves within a very difficult economic dynamic that is in many ways driven by the national economic climate, but it's also driven by a recalcitrant legislature that requires a supermajority to make any changes to the tax code, which allows the Republican minority to have great power over what happens. So I'm not sure that there's some magic bullet president who could come in and solve these problems, but I do think that it's hard for people to trust Mark Udoff when, for example, in 2002 he published a letter in support of what he called the hybrid university, where he essentially made the case for why the great public institutions of the United States had no choice but to privatize. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's just. And I don't think that accords with the California Master Plan for Public Education. So,
you think he's confused about the University of Phoenix?
I see you've got a better line on this than I do. But listen, here's my position. It's very simple. I've read a lot of very thick books trying to understand the world, and I haven't figured out that much. But I figured out about two things. One, a colonial power should probably never invade Afghanistan. It seems to end poorly. And two, never give anyone emergency powers. It seems to always be a mistake. And as long as we have this situation of emergency powers, essentially an autocratic office of the president operating by fiat rather than shared governance and a chance for all concerned parties to work together to protect public education in California, this is not going to end in a pretty way.
Well, I would just suggest I agree with your 2 points, but you probably have a little more wisdom than that. Now, Joshua, in the 3 demands that you laid out, to me, one of the most critical is this process, the issue of consultation and respect for the faculty. Do you think that there's a play here where you can somehow leverage this walkout to get Udoff to share the responsibility here and share some of the decision making so that there is more buy-in? Because we're not finished. The state is not out of the woods, so to speak. And I expect further cuts from the state general fund to the universities in the coming year or years. And so I think that he needs to understand that his future and the future of the university system is inextricably linked to your support and your input. Because if he tries to go this alone as a cowboy autocrat, he will crash and burn, and I can safely predict that right here, right now.
Well, I like your vision. I hope you're right. And I do think you're right. I also think it's not going to be a one-day struggle. A lot of effort has gone into organizing the plans for September 24th across the system in a very brief period of time. I think the students have started to take the lead, which I think is remarkable and admirable, and I am proud to be working with them. I think that labor is very involved, but I don't think it's going to be a one-day struggle. I think that if we can stand together in solidarity as a coalition, we will make this change.
Joshua Clover, you want to add anything else?
Thanks very much for taking the time to talk on this important matter.
My pleasure. And keep up the fight, will you?
Thanks so much.
Joshua Clover, he is an associate professor of English at the University of California, Davis. September 24th is the day that faculty, students, and employees will walk out system-wide from the University of California. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. We're sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic fruits and vegetables, it's time to drink organic wine. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. There's a special introductory offer for Peter B. Collins listeners. We appreciate your feedback and input to the program. You can always drop me a note, peter@peterbcollins.com. And Bob Hertz did that. He, of course, is the heir to the car rental fortune and director of the Health Care Crusade based in Minnesota. Bob, welcome to our program today.
Thank you very much, Peter. Good to be here.
That car rental fortune thing, I made that up.
Oh, I know.
Well, thank you for getting in touch because, you know, we've been hearing a lot of angry voices amped up by corporate steroids, mob mentality, people carrying guns to presidential town hall meetings, people trained like chimpanzees to interrupt members of Congress at their town hall meetings. And so I wanted to hear from you. Tell me, first of all, what is the Healthcare Crusade? Is that you and your computer, or is this a group of people?
Well, it's me and all the people that subscribe to my newsletter. I've had a newsletter for quite a while. There's a couple hundred subscribers. And it's really an attempt to put on the agenda a left-wing approach to healthcare, which concentrates on price gouging, billing fraud, and predatory insurance. And these will be problems no matter what happens in the coming months in Washington. Mm-hmm. No matter what happens in Washington, 80 or 90% of us will not have what a Canadian or a German or a Swede or a Norwegian would consider decent insurance.
That's because we're not socialists, Bob. We're capitalists who want to see, you know, kind of leeches make money off the ill health of the average American. And they're doing it, you know, it's working very well for them. And I'd like to get your reaction to the Baucus proposal, because I was stunned to see the combination of personal mandates, the federal government requiring me to carry health insurance. Now, I already do, but there are plenty of people who don't, and largely they do so because they simply cannot afford it. And then we have the bailout for the most profitable industry in America today, the insurance, the commercial insurance carriers. And that's the $350 billion, or do I have that number right? No, it's $463 billion in federal credits to help low-income people who will be forced into the arms of these insurance companies. And there's no real mechanism here to even restrain, much less reduce, the cost of health insurance. So this is a huge windfall for the commercial insurance companies. And they're going to use almost $500 billion of our taxpayer money and essentially just give it to them.
What most Americans do not understand, and it's taken me a lot of reading to do this, I recommend any books by Joseph White or U.A. Reinhart, is that in almost all other countries of the world, people contribute to insurance, to health insurance, in proportion to their income.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that often enough. In proportion to their income, the more you make, the more you pay. The less you make, the less you pay. We haven't the guts, and to some extent, we don't have the understanding nationally to just make that happen. And so we get these Byzantine structures, as you comment, Byzantine and corrupt structures, like Baucus's, in which first they're going to make you buy something for $500 or $600 a month that you haven't a prayer of affording. And then maybe, and I put it maybe with a big underline, they'll give you $200 or $300 back through some obscure tax credit that even myself with an actuarial and legal background can't even always understand.
Mm-hmm.
This is crazy. Charge according to income. That's the real public option.
Well, and that $463 billion of federal taxpayer money would go a long way if they put it into Medicare and expanded the eligibility of Medicare below age 65 and to people who are self-employed or who have other reasons for being unable to participate in an employer pool.
I totally agree. Medicare should expand. I'm hesitant to expand the entire Medicare package only because we are having trouble paying for it with seniors. For example, we might focus on... Certainly, Medicare should cover emergency rooms. Emergency rooms, which are not bad places, which tend to be very democratic, and in Minnesota at least, are well run and again, run fairly on the most part. Emergency rooms should be a public responsibility. You don't need insurance to call the fire department. You don't need fire insurance to call the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come to your house.
Yep.
The men and women who answer 911 don't ask if you have coverage. That's the way health care should be in emergency settings. So at least Medicare should do that. Medicare should also cover very large bills.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great saying that government should do for people what they cannot do for themselves. Most people, thank God, most people can afford a few doctor visits, a few pills, but they can't afford large, devastating costs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I only disagree with you here slightly because I don't dispute that Medicare has financial issues going forward. But I think that if we were to expand the pool and more people are invested in it, many interpretations of that term, that it would give us the mandate and the incentive to work to improve Medicare and to remove the ban on negotiating price from pharmaceutical companies in the Part D legislation that was rammed through by the Republicans. And there are other ways that I think that we could improve Medicare, make it more financially sound. And part of that is to expand coverage as far as possible so that everybody is in the risk pool. That's and you're the actuary here. Explain to people a little bit why broadening the participation reduces the overall risk.
It does because the healthcare is going to cost money. It may cost more in one place than the other, but it's always going to cost money. And so the issue is, are the monies required only paid by the users? The term user fee is very much in healthcare lingo. If it's only paid by the users, that means it's that the people who are sick have to pay all the costs of the hospital, all the building costs and the nurse, the laundry costs and the chaplain's cost and the flowers cost, everything in the hospital has to be paid by the user. Or, are the costs spread broadly? But, you know, we shouldn't stop at just negotiating price. There are some areas where we should just dictate price.
Mm-hmm.
The Food and Drug Administration, unfortunately, is somewhat of a shill for the drug companies. When a new drug comes out, they should state the maximum price of that drug. Not just negotiate, just say, this drug can, you know, $120 for a month's supply. That's mm-hmm. it. Now you can charge less, and fine, but you can't charge more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree with that in principle. And, you know, we see that there are a lot of things missing from this alleged overhaul of health care reform. First of all, it's been dialed back. We're making marginal changes in health insurance, but we're not shifting that to provide competition. We don't have a mechanism to control costs in the future. There's no rollback in prices, even though the cost of health insurance over the last 10 years has increased by 131%. At the same time that wages went up only 38%, inflation went up only 28%. And so that price gouging is something that the Democrats and Republicans are not even addressing. And we basically just have to get on the bus at the current fare, if you will, and there is no assurance that these changes that are being proposed will have any breaking effect on the escalation of health insurance and the underlying services that often drive up the cost of health insurance.
That's right. But one thing in my proposals is that people will rebel against this mandate and find ways to avoid it. And that's not a good thing, but it's going to happen.
Well, to me, Bob, excuse me for interrupting, but the only way for a mandate to be fair and effective is to provide free coverage for the people who can't afford it. Then a mandate is sensible, and it has the desired effect of expanding the pool and incentivizing people to go to the doctor before they're seriously ill so that we don't bear the costs of undiscovered illnesses that have progressed way down the road to both greater expense and greater risk to the individual.
Yes, and I agree with you. And what my group also wants to supplement that with a program of emergency loans for the inevitable people who, and your listeners will include some people like this. If you read blogs and letters to the editor, there are always people, there are thousands of them across the country, who fall through the cracks, claims are denied, insurance companies fail, insurance companies are deceitful, they themselves buy insurance and then forget to pay the premium and it's canceled. Many people, no matter what happens, will fall through the cracks. And so one thing we can do with a very small amount of government money is if you run up a bill that you cannot cover, the government would give you an interest-free loan and not a credit card, thank you. No interest.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interest-free loan, and you would pay it back through your taxes, and maybe you wouldn't get a refund until it was paid back. But it would prevent devastation.
Mm-hmm.
During this interim time when people will fall through the cracks.
Yeah. Now, Bob, let's look at the politics of this. What is wrong with the Democrats? They won an important election last year, and one of the key issues that they ran on was reforming health care. And the first thing Obama did was snub the single-payer team. John Conyers had to beg to be invited to that White House meeting where they kicked off the this legislative effort back in March. And the president sent these signals from the beginning that he was not going to confront the health care industry, the health insurance industry, or the pharmaceutical companies. And so we have seen in recent weeks the joint session of Congress where Obama gave a speech. He is still trying to win over Republican votes. And it doesn't take a political scientist to figure out that the obstructionist Republicans will never support this effort in any way, shape, or form. And so he's been negotiating with himself and watering down proposals that were not that rich in calories to begin with. And now, he's lamely, and kind of gamely talking about the public option, while at the same time he says it's not essential, he won't draw a veto line, And it was interesting to see at the University of Maryland, where he gave a kind of pep rally speech this week, that the students cheered him when he talked about the public option and booed Max Baucus when his name was mentioned and the proposal that his committee brought forward.
Mm-hmm. The Democrats have forgotten that health care is really a pocketbook issue, and the goal is to have things be cheaper. That making things more expensive for working people is the wrong way to go. Part of this, I believe, part of this is blindness. Part of this, though, is an utter unwillingness to raise taxes on anybody, on virtually anybody, and that leads to these crazy things, as you mentioned, these contorted mandates with subsidies that may or may not be there, and asking industries which have never really told the truth to give discounts, which is an empty promise they don't have to keep. At a certain point, it's time to be grown-ups and to say, if this is a worthy cause and we raise taxes on a broad enough basis, do you know that raising all income tax brackets by 1%, which really covers people who make over $25,000 or $30,000 a year, under $25,000 you pay very little in income tax, although you do pay payroll taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Raising income taxes by 1% raises half a trillion over your 10-year period. That's half the battle. 1%. No one is going to barrel into a town meeting, unless they're a real whack job, and shoot it up because of 1%. You've got to have broad-based taxes to pay for these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. And the Baucus plan to tax so-called Cadillac insurance plans, I don't think there are enough Cadillacs out there to generate the kind of revenue that they're proposing. Bob, how can people get in touch with you if they would like to sign up for your online newsletter?
There are two ways. One is you can go through Google or through your internet to www.healthcarecrusade.com.
Okay.
www.healthcarecrusade.com. That will have sample articles that I have written and others have contributed to and tell more what we're doing. Another way is to send me an email, bob.hertz@frontiernet.net, bob.hertz@frontiernet.net, and I will send you what I think is our lead article for these couple of months that you read, Peter, and I think got you interested. And we'll start up a correspondence, and I'll make you a subscriber. There's no cost.
Great. I wish you were in the Senate, Bob.
Well, someday. No, actually, the Republicans are more clever by half. They are going to come on when this is all over, whatever, however it ends, as the defenders of the average working American, and the Democrats have gotten flummoxed into this position, and there'll need to be a health care candidate, I think, in 2012.
Bob, great to talk with you. Thanks for getting in touch with me.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's Bob Hertz in Minnesota here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Now, before I wrap up today, I want to share with you another underhanded effort coming from the right and corporate interests. They're not satisfied that Glenn Beck got Van Jones fired. And as I've pointed out, the White House capitulation on that has only invited further attacks, and they're coming. They're coming on a daily basis. They're carefully orchestrated. And so I got a whole raft, a wave of emails this week. And the text is largely the same. It's a lengthy diatribe that goes on for 5 or 6 pages. And the various versions of this are slightly different. But what unifies them is that they have the same essential talking points. And there are cases of bad grammar and punctuation to make it look like an average person wrote this shit. But it's clearly part of a very carefully orchestrated effort, and I have no proof of this, so I'm in speculation mode as I say this, but it's got Frank Luntz written all over it. And so this letter, this one here, is addressed to Joe Lieberman, a former Democrat. Yeah, he was once our vice presidential nominee in 2000, if you remember. And this letter, as I say, is a screed that goes on and on. But they start with Bill Ayers. They link Obama to the Weather Underground. And then they go after some low-level appointees. John Holdren, who is director of the White House Office of Science and Technology. And they go back to a 1977 book that he wrote where he speculated about ways to reduce the population growth, including putting birth control into the water. Now, he's entitled to explore that. I've not read his work. But this is the kind of effort that they used on Van Jones. They cherry-pick something out of context from your history and then try to paint the whole Obama administration with it. So from Holdren, they go on to Cass Sunstein. And he, of course, won confirmation from the Senate recently. One of these letters urges that every senator who voted for Sunstein's confirmation should be impeached. The letters try to link Barack Obama to the Communist Party via Frank Marshall Davis, and they link him to a guy who doesn't have a last name in Obama's book Dreams from My Father, a guy named Frank, and they just conclude, therefore, Obama's a communist. Now, I wish Obama were as wildly liberal and dangerously unconventional and un-American as they say. I might be happier with the progress of this health care reform. But this stuff is ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. And they are flooding the media and the internet with this stuff. And so, as I looked at this as a product of the Republican noise machine, I got one of these ridiculous fundraising appeals with a survey that came from Michael Steele, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, and he asked me 15 questions. I won't read all of them to you, but I will tell you that these themes are reflected in the same gibberish of those emails that I was just referring to. Here are the questions that come in the Republican questionnaire. Do you agree with Obama's budget plan that will lead to a $23.1 trillion deficit over the next 10 years? Do you believe the federal government has gone too far in bailing out failing banks, insurance companies, and the auto industry? Now, of course, they never mention that these are debacles that are the responsibility of the preceding Republican administration. And Obama and the Democrats were forced to clean up this crap because the Republicans wouldn't vote for any of it. And I've got my own problems with the bailouts. And as I've told you, the Cash for Clunkers deal was the right way to help Detroit, not the almost $20 billion in loans that we gave them that we'll never see back. All right, the questionnaire goes on. Do you support amnesty for illegal immigrants? Should English be the official language? Are you in favor of granting retroactive Social Security eligibility to illegal immigrants who gain U.S. citizenship through an amnesty program? I mean, these are not just hypothetical. These are things that are designed to inflame people. Now, I understand the purpose of this survey is to get people angry so they'll write a check to the Republican National Committee. But what's important to note is that these are the same themes that the teabaggers are promoting, that Dick Armey's phony front groups are promoting, that Americans for Prosperity and their mouthpiece Glenn Beck are promoting. And it's time for Obama and the Democrats to stand up and fight. Now, my old friend Nancy Pelosi gave a kind of emotional response at a news conference this week that she fears that we are about to go over the edge into political violence. I don't disagree with her point, and I respect her for being willing to say it. But that emotional approach just creates a new vulnerability for the attack dogs. It's time to confront these monsters. They're using anarchist tactics. Slash and burn, destroy at any cost. And you cannot counter that with an emotional appeal, even with a thoughtful refutation. We've got to fight back. We've got to shut these people down. Not in an undemocratic way, not by, you know, manipulating the government or the media to do so, but through the sheer power of moral suasion, rational thinking, and a clear rejection of compromise. Are you listening, Harry Reid? Are you listening, Nancy Pelosi? Thank you for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins, and I'd love to hear from you. Drop me an email.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.